Well, good morning, and just give you a quick overview. Hopefully, I won't bore you to death, but this is about a little over a year ago. I did 2 weeks on the third hour about some stuff on science and creation, and I've done a couple things in the men's class, and this is kind of a summary of some of that stuff. So some of it's going to be a review, hopefully, especially for the men, because I did some of this to the men not too long ago. But as the women will be glad to tell you, the men need it anyways. Because they forget everything they're told pretty much most of the time anyways, right? Matter of fact, I can just blame my problem I found out this week on early stages of Alzheimer's. You saw the new or one of the latest scientific studies my wife pointed out to me, so-called scientific studies. But if you have trouble distinguishing smells, the smell of things, that's supposedly now a sign of that you're high risk for Alzheimer's. And my wife can tell you I can't smell anything, so I probably have it already. So I'm on my way. Anything I forget, I just blame on Alzheimer's from now on, because I've got some science behind it, so-called science behind it, to block that. I got to do one thing here I forgot to do. Again, it's Alzheimer's all the time that gets you in trouble. I can't see either. That's another problem. So... this is, you know, again, about God's wisdom and man's pursuit of his own as a review of some of this stuff. And if you remember the series a while back, a lot of this is coming from 1 Corinthians 1:22, where Paul tells us that the Jews seek after signs and the Greeks or the Gentiles seek after wisdom. And the majority of us in this room are Gentiles or part of the Greeks, and we do seek after wisdom. And you can look at our culture and see that what do we honor, what do we seek after? Wisdom, especially in our so-called modern world, wisdom is all important, and we all want to be wise, in our own eyes at least, or something. And again, I think there's three points that we can get from that verse, or three things that we need to keep in mind. First of all, man does seek after his own wisdom, especially if you're a Greek or Gentile. You don't care about the sign so much. You want to see the wisdom. And in the process, we mock God's wisdom, because we know that God is our man in wisdom and God's wisdom are opposed to one another. So we consequently often mock it. And we have to expect that as believers. I think there's also an exhortation not to be fooled. And the main purpose of this things I'm going to share today is this point two. That we don't get fooled by man's wisdom, accepting things which sound very wise and very smart and are tempting, and everyone around us believes it. And yet, if we apply good biblical thinking, we can see the weaknesses of it. And that's what I'm hoping to accomplish today, just to show you some of the weaknesses in their thinking and how you can easily determine what's out there. And of course, what goes with that is, as the old man does crave that wisdom, and we love to be seen by our peers as being wise. How many of you would, how many of you sit in a meeting and there's always someone there who has to be the smartest guy in the room? And deep down, probably a lot of us wish we were the smartest guy in the room in those discussions, and we sort of want to be that, and yet hopefully that wisdom that we're going to show is God's wisdom, not ours. And I think the thing we need to remember here is what the Scriptures teach about man's wisdom. They profess to be wise, but what are they really? Fools. And we need to keep that in mind all the time, that although they profess to be wise, they are actually fools. And I hope some of the stuff I share today would show how foolish some of the stuff they believe in is. Just to set the groundwork, this is hopefully a complete review. What is science? It's just a collection and organization of facts gathered through the scientific method. And that's all science really is. If you get beyond that, you're no longer into it. And probably the key thing, again, to always ask yourself, whenever you see something that's being presented as science or scientific or whatever, is it observable and repeatable? If it's not observable and repeatable, it's not science. It may go under the guise of science, and they may say it's science, but the only thing that science, empirical science, is observable and repeatable. If you can't observe it and you can't repeat it, and I could say under observable could include measurable. It's got to be measurable, observable, whatever you want to say. It has to be some type of quantitative measurement you can take, and it has to be repeatable or it's not science. Most of what goes on under science does not fit those two criteria. And we're going to look at the three common abuses of it. And if it's not science, it's not a fact, it's not observable. An example of something which is observable and repeatable is the law of gravity. Every time we drop something, it falls down. There hasn't been one exception yet where someone's dropped something and it went up. Now, you can make some things happen in a vacuum, but still, we know that when you drop something, it falls down. The first time your chair gets up and slaps you alongside the face, you know that the law of gravity is no longer true. That would be an example of something that's observable and repeatable. Many things, again, in science, as we're going to see, are not observable and repeatable. Quick example that obviously should be obvious to everyone is the creation of the universe. Can that ever go into the realm of science? Who's there to observe it, and are we going to repeat it? Now, technically, under some concept of the Big Bang Theory, it is repeatable. Some people believe that there was a Big Bang that exploded 20 billion years ago, but that's happened numerous times, actually an infinite number of times, because that's the only way to explain how the universe and matter came into existence to begin with, is to say that the universe and matter is eternal. How else do you get the beginning of anything? Some people would say that, some of your really committed scientists, atheists, would say that matter is eternal, and we've had numerous Big Bangs, infinite number of Big Bangs, because it just keeps happening again and again and again, and I'm not going to go into all that, but basically, there's no way that the creation of the universe can be science, because it's not observable or repeatable. And even those who believe in the Big Bang and say it is repeatable would tell you that it won't happen the same way a second and third time. So it doesn't fall under the category of being repeatable because it's not going to happen the same way, so you'd get different results every time. And a lot of you were here early, saw my Star Wars concept that I have in the background of my computer. And what Star Wars, the whole concept of different types of life on different planets is the whole thing about Big Bang theory, that if you had a Big Bang, life would develop differently each time. And it wouldn't be the same on every, in fact, some of those who believe that there's other life forms out there in the universe would believe that whatever evolved on those other planets was not like flesh and blood we have here. So that's a whole concept behind Star Wars. It's actually part of the fact that evolution would happen differently on different planets or different time periods, and it's not the same. One of the things I want to make sure that we don't do as part of this is come to the conclusion that science is wrong. Science is not wrong in and of itself. It's the abuses of science, like everything else. Alcohol is not wrong. It's the abuses of alcohol that's wrong. It's always the abuses that man does. Science has contributed an awful lot to our life. And we have the standard of living we do primarily because of what a lot of the scientific discoveries we've had. What we need to always be doing is distinguishing what's science and what's not. Where we're crossing into, it's not observable and repeatable, therefore it's no longer science. It's one of the things we're going to talk about shortly. Adam started off being a scientist, because what did he do? Right away, he named every animal. Just think, I've often thought about that. If you were placed in the Garden of Eden and you had to name every animal, think about the mental processing that would take. How many animals do we have in the animal kingdom? Recognizing that because of microevolution, we're the original creation is deteriorating and going to dust. We have a lot more animal, so-called animal species today than he had, but still, he had thousands of animals he had to name. If I start trotting animals up here and I ask you to start naming them, I bet you most of you get tired after 100 or so and start having real trouble trying to come up with a unique name for animals after you've seen 100 or so animals. Can you imagine the mental processes that took Adam to name all of them? Anyways, that's off the subject. What we do need to know, though, while science is God's and there's a lot of valuable things of science, secular humanism has corrupted science to promote its own agenda. And its own agenda is what? What? Anti-God. I mean, their philosophy of anti-God. In fact, what are they actually promoting, especially the atheist? That man is king, not God, and science has all the answers. I mean, secular humanism has its own religion. They just don't want to call it a religion. And science is their God, and the scientific method, and the scientist is the priest. Let's face it, I mean, there is a very anti-God philosophy developed around animals that can't be spelled right. I didn't realize I had animals spelled wrong. In fact, there's a couple of mistakes in there. Anyways, never, always good to, one of the things I found out really early in my life is I can't proofread anything. Because it says what I want it to say, whether it says it or not. Did you ever write something and go back and try to read it? It says, I can read it 10 times. It says exactly what I want it to say. Even though it doesn't say that. So anyways, what are some limits of man's wisdom? Well, we're going to look at some of the things. Again, it has to be observable and repeatable. If it's not, it's not really science. And there's 3 common abuses to science that hopefully you can recognize. And some of these I've talked about before, so there'll be a review. But the 3 common abuses of science are extrapolation, statistical studies, and inferences and logical deductions. Those 3 things are regularly abused by science, and they're relatively easy to recognize. And what I want to try to do is cover those 3 abuses and not only what they are, but why they're abuses, and on top of that, some ways you can easily recognize it so you know it's not science when you read about it in the paper. Before I cover those 3 abuses, though, one of the questions, and I'm hoping to get done early enough to have some question and answer, which hopefully some people in the audience will help me answer the question, because I'm not sure I know all the answers. But anyways, I know I don't. I don't have to think. I think I don't know. I know I don't know. But anyways, why do so many so-called intelligent people believe in such science? Hopefully some of the things that I'm going to show and talk about are pretty obvious, and you can't help but ask yourself, don't they know that too? And they do. If you read scientific writings, which fortunately most of you won't, because it's covered in scientific jargon, it just puts you to sleep. But if you actually read their own writings and journals they write for themselves, they know that a lot of what they say is not true, and it's not science. People working in the field, as an example of evolution, they know that they'll tell you that we have no idea how it happens. We believe it, even though we have no idea how it happens, because the only alternative is God. And we don't want to accept God into the picture. So we keep on going on looking for some way that would actually explain how you can evolve from an amoeba into a fish or a human being, because they have no idea whatsoever, and they'll openly admit it in their own writings of what the method is. Darwin's original thing, survival of the fittest and changes of genes, stuff like that, they know can't possibly be true. There's just no way that it works out mathematically or any other ways. So they know that stuff is not true. Why do they believe it anyways? Well, most of them started out like most of us. They take the word of their teachers or professors, in most cases professors, and never bother looking at it themselves. I can tell you, most of you know that I went to college as an agnostic and came out of college as an atheist and an evolutionist. And while I accepted everything I was taught in college as being true. I never investigated anything. I'd be willing to bet John could tell you a lot of Bible students at Lancaster Bible College didn't bother studying anything, really knowing what it says. All they want to know is, how do I get an A? Or in some cases, how do I get a C so I can pass or whatever? I mean, all they want to know is, what do I need for the test, right? That's the way most college kids are. What do I need to know for the test? Get me out of this class. That's all I care about. So they start off in their careers by never really investigating what they're taught in college. They believe what they're taught, and they accept it. I did that. It wasn't until after I was saved that I went back and started studying what I was taught. One of the standard five truths of evolution is that in the development of the womb of a human being, they retrace their evolutionary path. And there's an amoeba stage, and there's an algae colonial stage, and there's a beast stage and a fish stage that was commonly taught as one of the five proofs of evolution. That was actually disproved in 1932. It was originally proposed back in the late 1800s, early 1900s, and based on the technology that was available at that point, they thought it was true. I mean, it wasn't like they were lying about that. That's what they thought they saw in the embryonic development of a human being. But microscopes had progressed to the point by 1932 that was proven to be false. I went to college in the early 1970s, and I was taught that was one of the five proofs of evolution in 1970s. You rarely see it being taught today, but occasionally you'll come across a textbook, even today, that still has that as one of the five proofs, even though we've known for almost 100 years now that that's not true. A lot of people take the word of their professors just because they think the professors know what they're talking about. It's the way the world works. The second reason why a lot of these people do, they start out their career believing what they're professors start, they get into a career, and if the way the scientific world works right now, if you want to, the majority of jobs for scientists are either, a lot of them are in universities, or they're in some type of government or privately funded organization like the Cancer Society and places like that. And how do you get your money to keep those places in business? A lot of that's colleges and all these private things. They rely very heavily on grants and scholarships and things of that nature. And if you want to get money today for some project you want to do, you don't oppose the orthodoxy. Because who controls the orthodoxy of science? It's your powerful professors. And they're on board for science of the secular humanism. And if I'm a young scientist just out of college and I want to get a job, I don't go out there and start talking about opposing evolution or global warming or some of these buzzword scientific things of secular humanism, because if I do, I've narrowed my job possibilities down now to a very few choices. If I want to have any type of career today in science, I better stick with the orthodoxy. It's the way, and that's always been true. You go back to the 1600s or 1500s. What did people believe back in those days about the earth? It was flat. And if you opposed that, you were out. Now, there wasn't anywhere near the number of scientists back in those days, but science always has had a very strong orthodoxy, just like same thing's true for religions, a lot of other things, and if you oppose it, you really limit your career possibilities. So even though, the third reason, you might say, okay, well, what about the guys that have worked in their life, their whole life, and they no longer have to worry about their career, they actually know it's false, and occasionally you have someone come out late in their life, usually, when their career is pretty much set, and oppose some of the main teachings. There's been a guy recently came out against global warming who's in his late 50s. He doesn't have to worry about his career anymore. He's come out and said, you know, global warming is a hoax, basically. What happens to him? The third reason why people don't come out is they got to protect their reputation from the media, because the media is on board as part of secular humanism. If you don't, I mean, we all know that. We see that every day. The media is totally on board supporting secular humanism. If you come out against any of the popular secular humanism things, they're going to destroy you. Unless you've lived a sinless life, which none of us have, the media is going to go back and dig up something you did somewhere along in your career and expose it and destroy your reputation. So even scientists who are late in their career, who know it's false, are not going to come out, in most cases, against it. And if they do, they're very brave people because the media will destroy them. Between the science hierarchy, who are all on board, and the media, you'll get destroyed. So they actually know that the stuff I'm going to share next is basically true, but they're not going to come out against it because of those three reasons. It just doesn't make sense. So let's look at these three abuses. The first one is extrapolations. It's probably the most common abuse of science. You measure something in the present, and you either project it forward or backwards. You can do it either way. But you're taking something that is science, you're measuring something, observing something, it's repeatable, it's observable. That's science. But then as soon as you take that and you start projecting it either into the past or into the future, one way or the other, you leave science, and we'll talk about why. Some common examples of extrapolations is evolution itself. Evolution is all an extrapolation from microevolution. We know, because we observe and repeat it, that species, what we call species, because species is an arbitrary word, they change over time into other species, so-called species. Finches. The thing that originally started Darwin on his theory was the finches on the Galapagos Islands. We know that the finches can, from one common finch, you can make a lot of different types of finches, so-called finches, again. Are they really a species we could debate, which I'm not going to get into today. But that's an example of, we know microevolution is true, but we extrapolate that into the past. So what we say, the logic is, okay, it's happening now. If it's always been happening, then it's somewhat logical. To say, well, couldn't it happen in the past? And if we had the Earth long enough and old enough, well, then maybe it's possible to extract so for a fish to evolve into something else. Or from an amoeba, spit that out, to eventually evolve into man. That's an extrapolation. We measure something in the present, we do backwards. Global warming is the exact same thing, except we're going forward in global warming. We're measuring temperature changes over time. And through the 90s, the 80s and the 90s, temperatures were getting warmer every year. And people from that projected that forward and said, well, if it keeps on this trend, by the year, 2100 or so, we'll have the Earth so warm that it will start having problems with the ocean levels rising and stuff like that. That was the original thing behind global warming. The problem is, besides the fact that it's a projection, and we'll talk about the problems with extrapolations or projections next, the temperatures haven't been warming the last 10 years. The last 10 years, they've pretty much stayed steady, so that's a questionable thing to begin with. Another example of extrapolation is radioactive dating. We often talk about how this dating method tells you how old this rock is or how old such is, and that's all based on the same thing. You measure something in the present, which you can do, and then you extrapolate it, in this case, backwards again, to say, well, if the rate of decay, because radioactive decay is all about this thing, one substance changes to another substance. So you measure how much you have of both substances, and then you can extrapolate backwards to say how old the thing is based on the two measurements of this changes to that over time. They're both extrapolations. And an extrapolation you can all do in your head is this, and I've done this before, so most of you hopefully know the answer right off the bat. You don't have to even think about it. If you were faced with this, someone told you this, it's snowing at 2 inches an hour, and it snows for 3 hours, how much snow is on the ground? And if you do an extrapolation, I would get the answer of 6 inches. And if you did that, you've done a very accurate extrapolation. And the thing about extrapolations, though, they're very accurate. In some cases, extrapolation equipment costs millions of dollars. Usually, the actual measurement is very scientific. And the equipment used to it can be very expensive. And the scientists may have spent a lot of time doing very detailed calculations and measurements and stuff. The problem is there actually 6 inches of snow on the ground? Well, there may be. And then again, there may not be. Because you did do an extrapolation. And the thing about extrapolation, it doesn't matter how scientific, or I shouldn't say, it doesn't matter how expensive, how long, and how detailed the calculations are for the initial calculation, they're always based on assumptions. When you did your snow calculation, you made three assumptions at least, three common assumptions. Most radioactive dating methods use the same three. In fact, all radioactive dating methods use the same three assumptions. Evolution makes some assumptions. They all make assumptions whenever you do an extrapolation. So what extrapolations did you make? Well, first of all, you decided that the rate was constant. I said it's snowing at a rate of 2 inches per hour. I didn't say it continued at that rate the whole 3 hours, did I? And does snow normally continue at the same rate for long periods of time? If you've been through any snowstorms, you know there's usually a fluctuations in the rate. We don't know whether the rate's constant or not. How long have we known about radioactive dating is used and considered to be very accurate by some people. Scientists will tell you, it tells you exactly how old rocks are and stuff. How long have we known about radiation decay? You know when radiation was first discovered or written about? Probably was discovered long before we wrote about it, but it goes back to the right around 1900, give or take a little bit. So how long have we known about radiation? Little over 100 years. Radioactive decay methods, one of the more common ones is uranium to lead. Uranium changes to lead. The so-called decay rate is 4.5 billion years. So if they're trying to measure how old something is and they find some uranium and lead in the rock layer where they find something, they'll measure how much uranium is and how much lead there is, and then they conclude that this rock is, you know, 10 billion years old or whatever because of the decay rate. However, is the decay rate observable and repeatable? Do we really know that that decay rate is constant for 4.5 billion years? Well, we might know that in about 15 billion years. But until we can repeat it observable several times through, we don't know whether that rate is actually constant for all 4.5 billion years. So we're making an assumption that the decay rate is the same. We don't know that that's true, but we assume it's true. It may or may not be true. That's the whole point of this stuff. Second thing that you assumed is you assumed that no snow melted. What often happens, snow, it's raining, it's snowing like crazy sometimes, but as soon as it hits the ground, it melts. And therefore, when you're done, it could be snowing for 3 hours and you end up having no snow in the ground, right? Essentially, you assumed that it was a closed system, that none of the stuff entered or no other materials entered or left the system while you were during that time period, that from the beginning to the end of the period. So in the case of radioactive decay or radioactive methods that are used for dating, some of them are gases. Potassium argon, argon's a gas, and they measure how much of the two that you have. What's the chances that some of the gases might have escaped? We don't know. Again, we make an assumption that we can't prove one way or the other. The third assumption you made is that there was no snow already on the ground. Because I asked you how much snow was on the ground at the end of the 3 hours. If there was 12 inches of snow on the ground when it started, and there might be 18 inches on the ground. In the case of radioactive decay, we're measuring how much potassium or lead, or potassium and argon, or uranium and lead. We know what we found. What we don't know is how much of was there in the layer when it first was created. We can only guess at that. We don't have any idea what the initial composition of the thing we're measuring was. Because we can't go back 4 billion years, whatever, and get that, 10,000 years, whatever the measurement is. We have no idea what the composition of the initial materials were. And the most accurate dating method that we have by far is carbon-14 dating. Carbon-14 dating, which is the carbon-14, carbon-14 decays into carbon-12, which is the common carbon over time. We have no idea, that's relatively accurate measurement. It only goes back into the thousands of years, though. You can't measure millions of years with carbon-14. You're talking about thousands of years at most. And therefore, it's basically within biblical time periods to begin with. The second thing about carbon-14 dating is if there was, if the Bible's true and there was a Noah's flood, there's every indication in the scriptures that the world before the flood was much different than the world after the flood. And therefore, the assumption, we know pretty accurately how much carbon-14 and carbon-12 ratios are normally. Therefore, when we find someone who can figure out the decay rate, we can be pretty accurate with our half-life thing. But if the world was different before the flood, particularly a lot of Bible scholars believe there was a water canopy before the flood, that would drastically alter the amount of carbon-14 to carbon-12 ratio. So any materials that were pre-flood would, any measurements done with carbon-14 dating would be no way of knowing what the ratios were. Therefore, the accuracy are very questionable at that point. So basically, as an example of the way this stuff all works, extrapolations are always based on assumptions. If your assumptions are great, well, then you have very accurate and very detailed science. However, if one or more of your assumptions are wrong, you essentially have this situation. A very nice-looking building, very strong, very stable, but what's going to happen to that building is what happens to your scientific theories and all your measurements and all your calculations if your science is wrong. Or if any of your assumptions are wrong. That's how valuable your extrapolation is. And that's what happens to your extrapolation if even one of your assumptions is wrong. It now is worthless. It's just a pile of rubble. Yeah, you spend a lot of time and a lot of effort doing it, but you have nothing to show when it's all said and done because your assumptions were false. You built your stuff on assumptions that you can't prove. So extrapolations are commonly done. Anytime you look at something that's being measured in the present and then projected either backwards or forward, recognize it's extrapolation, it's based on assumptions, and the accuracy is totally based on how good your assumptions are. And if I have a choice, I'm not finished with your treatise yet, Charlie, but I've been working on it, and if I have a choice between believing God's word and science built on a bunch of assumptions, what are you going to choose? I think I'd go with God's word over a bunch of assumptions that I can't prove one way or the other, or it may take a long time to prove one way or the other. That's many times your choice. And recognize making the choice that I'm going to believe God's word is a lot better than taking the choice I'm going to believe man's wisdom at that point, because you're... Their wisdom is based on assumptions. The second common abuse of science is the whole thing of statistical studies. Studies using statistics. And we see this almost every day, especially in the medical health area, where they come out with all kinds of scientific studies. I know. I forgot where I'm clicking. And I asked this question a while back, and a lot of you would want to say, yes, this has been proven, that smoking causes cancer. Is that a scientific fact? Well, is it observable and repeatable? It's not a scientific fact. If it would be, the only way it could be a scientific fact would be if everyone who smoked any length of time got cancer. And I'm sure you all know people that have smoked for a long time and haven't gotten cancer. It's not a scientific fact. Now, that does not mean I'm telling you to go out and smoke today, by the way, but we'll talk about that, but it's not scientifically proven. How many times do you, you watch the TV and ads on TV, everything is scientifically proven, this is going to help you, or this is going to hurt you, and try this product. I mean, advertisers use scientific studies all the time. They're all based on statistics. Yes. Right. Well, is it a proven fact? No, it's not. And we'll talk about what it is. And there is, I mean, I'm not suggesting you smoke. This is taken off of the National Cancer Institute's thing. And again, abuse of science. They make three points about the harms of smoking. Smoke is harmful to both. Cigarettes causes many types of cancers, and quitting smoking reduces your risk. Now, if you look at those statements, basically, the first and third points are good points. But the second point is a misrepresentation of science, because that's not what science has said. Science has not said and cannot say that smoking causes cancer. The only way, again, that they could say that would be if everyone who smoked any length of time got cancer. And that's not a scientific fact. Therefore, it's not scientifically proven. How did they come to that conclusion? Well, they use statistical studies. Probability and statistics are often used in studies. And Barry, you're in here somewhere, aren't you? Barry, who does, this is big you take any type of philosophy, psychology, can't even spit that word out, thing, you get a lot of dose in statistics. Statistics are great for telling you that something's significant. They do some type of study, and they use some very sophisticated math formulas to find out whether something is significant or not. And the probability of things is usually 99% probability that that these two things are related. But all the statistical relationships show is that there is a relationship between these two factors or these two things that they've tested. They cannot and do not show cause and effect. What's a misrepresentation is, as soon as any type of thing says this causes something, you're misrepresenting science. You can say there's a relationship between smoking and cancer, but it doesn't cause it. It's a relationship. Our bodies and the way God made us is much too complex. The world we live in is much too complex to be able to come down to say this causes this. It's very tough to do that. Again, everyone who smokes would have to get cancer before that could be true. So we know there's a relationship. We know that there's a likelihood that, and if I go back to this slide before, certainly quitting smoking reduces your risk. We can say that smoking is a risk for cancer. That's nothing wrong with saying that. In fact, we should be saying that. Smoking is a risk we can't say that it causes it. As soon as you get into that statistical stuff where you start saying cause and effect, now you're into the area. Global warming would be somewhat of an example. They would say, okay, carbon, the levels of carbon causes the earth to warm. Well, that's a statistical study. We don't know that for sure. We can't prove that. So while we can say that there's a relationship, we can't say there's cause and effect. And what do we all know from our everyday life about these statistical studies? There's a statistical study, you know, eggs are bad for you. They'll cause you to die, have heart attacks. And then a couple years later, they tell you, oh, eggs are okay. You know, this type of sugar was bad for you. Oh, now it's okay. You know, that's an example of what statistical studies result in. And again, if something was based on some statistical study, all it's showing is that there's a relationship between these two factors. And there's liable to be another study sometime later that shows a different relationship because they measure something else, and a different relationship comes up. Generally speaking, this stuff is, statistical studies are very subject to changing over time. And it's not science, and they shouldn't even use the word scientific. It's nice that there's a relationship between these two things, but it's not a science, and it shouldn't be taken as science. Where am I at here time-wise? Okay, we're not doing too bad. The third abuse, which is often used, is just inferences and deductions. That we make logical deductions and inferences. This is what we have to do in many cases because we don't have any other choice. Because, again, it's not observable and repeatable. An inference is nothing but a conclusion based on the basis of reasoning and evidence. We do this all the time in the police and the fire world. Any of you would be involved in a fire investigation, police investigation, what are they doing? They're gathering as much evidence as they can and then drawing some reasoning from that, or they're making logical deductions. It's the process of reasoning from one or more statements up until you reach a logical conclusion about something. And there's nothing wrong with this per se, other than the fact that it's, again, it's not science, because your reasoning is only so good. What are you? You're a man. And what does God tell you about your reasoning? It's only so good, right? Mainly because we see what we want to see. That's one of the biggest weaknesses of logical deductions and reasoning. And it is based, again, on our world life view. How many of you, I'll pick on Nick, because I know Nick's a big rabid sports fan. And he's watching a game on TV, and the umpire makes the call. And what does Nick conclude? Makes a call against his team. What are you going to conclude, Nick? He was wrong, right. I saw it. He was out or he was safe, whatever it may be. And then they show it in instant replay in slow motion, and grudgingly, Nick admits to Dale that, yeah, the umpire got it right. Do you ever experience that? Any of you that are sports fan, Donnie, you've never had that happen, right? Slow motion and instant replay and the slow and stop motion, boy, they really make you feel bad as a sports fan some days. How many times you've seen it wrong. Both inferences and reasoning are all based on your world and life view, and we all tend to see what we want to see. And therefore, we can't trust our own reasoning very accurately. Some of the examples of this where they're using inferences and logical deductions, the geologic column. This is based basically on the fact that the layers of the earth, go to the Grand Canyon, see all these layers, and they tell you that some layers are older than other layers and they were formed at different time periods. That's basically based on the fact that the most primitive fossils are found on the bottom and the more advanced fossils are found in the top layers. And from that, they reason that, well, the bottom layers were laid down long ago and the top layers were laid down later in a different time period, and they show that the primitive life evolved into more complex life. And that's just logical deduction. The same thing is basically said about the bone structure of vertebrates. If you look at a fish, the progression of a number of bones between a fish and a human being is 207 to 211. And it's a few fused bones that make the difference between 207 and 211. And they're basically in the same position, same order, same everything. And from that, they conclude that fish and human beings have the same ancestor because they both have basically the same bone structure. And that's there's nothing wrong with the logical and reasoning as long as you recognize that it's based on your world and life view and that it's man's reasoning, not God's reasoning. That your view of the world and his view of the world are different. As long as you keep those two things in perspective, you're okay. And you could take both of these two examples, the geologic column. Is there another explanation for why the primitive stuff is on the bottom and the more complex stuff is on the top? If you believe those layers were laid down during Noah's flood, and there's a flood today, who's going to get buried first? The animals that can't move, right? The less what we would call the simple or less complex things are going to get buried first, because what are the more complex animals going to do? They're going to fight for survival. They're going to go to the highest spot possible. They're going to get buried later because they not only are more complex, they're more mobile. So mobility would just as easily explain why you tend to find that layer. And the one thing about the geologic column if that's if your explanation is they were laid down different time periods, then you always have to find the least complex on the bottom and the more complex on the top. And that's not what we find. We sometimes find either reversed order or we find mixed fossils. So you can't explain that from an evolutionary standpoint. From a mobility standpoint, the fact that during the flood these layers were all laid down, there would be some animals that would be injured, crippled, dumb, whatever, who would go the wrong direction. You've all seen animals who go run the wrong direction at times, right? And therefore, we would find some mixed layers or some reversed layers. The bone structure, one explanation, one inference or logical deductions I could draw is that they all came from the same source. I could also conclude they all came from the same creator. Why would God use a different plan for one animal versus another animal? If the plan worked for fish, wouldn't it basically work for man? He made some few modifications between the two, and it works for both. The same creator is just as logical as the same source, except that that involves a world and life view difference.
We have 10 minutes.
Okay, yeah, thanks. Fused together, right.
So you're making the assumption that you're drawing that measurement on an adult body.
Right.
And that's not always true.
Well, the final product is what that we're looking at this point. Yes, yeah, you're right. Stuff fuses along the way. Okay, I'm in good shape here. So let me, again, show you an example of an inference or deduction that you would probably make. After church someday, you're standing out there in the parking lot talking to someone, and you see someone, we won't identify that someone, come running out of the church and run into the cornfield across the street. And a few minutes later, smoke starts coming out of church. What are you going to deduct or draw the inference of? Whoever ran into the cornfield started the fire. Why are you going to conclude that? Okay, it's the first one out. What else might lead you to conclude that? He's running into the cornfield hiding, right? The more evidence I could grow or gather, the more valuable my inference would be. If the fire inspector came in and after doing the inspection for the start of the fire found some type of flammable material was used to start the fire, or that's where the fire started, and it started in a particular part of the church, whatever, would that make your evidence better or worse, or your conclusion better or worse? It would improve it, obviously. On the other hand, if he found that it was an electrical thing that started, that would actually make it less likely that the person started. If you could find the person who ran out and capture him or her and start interviewing them, and they told you, well, I was scared, and I just ran because I didn't know what else to do. Again, the more evidence I can collect, the better my long-term evidence and conclusion would be. But the bottom line is, will you ever know scientifically that person started the fire? You can draw an awful lot of evidence, you can get an awful lot of conclusions, but is it observable, repeatable? Therefore, it should not pass as science. It has to be put in its place where it is. Things like the geologic column and what else did I have? Oh, what do you call it? What was my other example? And I forget already. See, it's Alzheimer's kicking in again. Well, the bone structure. We'll never know. And it's never science. We can collect all the evidence in the world, and the more evidence we can collect, and the more that evidence seems to all point the same direction, the better our conclusion or deduction is. But it's not science. Don't pass it off as science. Pass it off with what it is. It's man's wisdom. And recognize that man's wisdom is always somewhat opposed to God's wisdom. And that doesn't mean, well, let's put it, the world system's wisdom is always going to be opposed to God. Godly wisdom, I mean, you go back to look at Sir Isaac Newton and some of these people that are scientists who started the Reformation period. You know what most of their studies were based on? Their thinking was based on the Word of God. That's where their starting point was for a lot of their stuff, and that's why it ended up being science that changed the world. That's what we need to do that. As a conclusion, I think there's a couple main reasons why why do we accept man's wisdom so easily? I'm talking about believers now more than anything else. I think there's a couple of basic reasons the Scriptures list why we accept man's wisdom, and it's a danger all of us have to watch. What was one of the original temptations to Eve? This would make her wise if she ate that apple, whatever she ate. It wasn't actually an apple, as far as we know, right, John? That was just a fruit. We don't know what... We often say it's an apple, but we don't know. I mean, we have that desire in this. We need to recognize that 1 Corinthians 1:2 tells us the Gentiles, which most of us probably are in this room, we seek after wisdom. There's something built into us that wisdom is an attractive to it. And well, you could say wisdom is pride. There's certainly pride. I'm smarter than you. Don't we all want to be smarter than everybody else? We want to be that smartest person in the room. That's why we often want to accept the world's wisdom. What we need to know is that beginning of fear, or beginning of wisdom, is fear of the Lord. And I think a lot of times we fear our colleagues more than we fear the Lord. Because if we do stick up for God's wisdom, what's probably going to happen to you in most secular environments? You're going to be looked at as some simpleton, idiot, Bible-believing fool. Therefore, the fear of the Lord has to be part of what we do. And we need to recognize continually that what has God chosen? The foolish thing to confound the wise. Again, it's that factor. I don't want to be looked at as being a fool in the world's eyes. And lastly, you have the choice that what are you going to stand on? Again, to me, it keeps coming down to this logical choice. Am I going to accept God's word, or am I going to go with man's wisdom? What's the smarter of the two things to stand on? I need to make sure that my faith is standing on God's word, not what the world tells me. Recognizing that there's some very big weaknesses in their thinking, because those three abuses you see all the time in science, in scientific studies. So that kind of concludes. I think we're almost done. I've got 3 minutes, I guess. So I got maybe time for one question if someone has a question. I do want to say one thing. I forget who told me this video originally, if I get the right one. There's a video out there that they went out and interviewed a whole bunch of people at college campuses and asked them about evolution. And if you've ever seen that video, you ought to watch it sometime. I know I could make it available on a DVD or something for someone to look at if you want to see it. But it's really comical how all these so-called smart college kids, when they start asking them detailed questions about why they believe what they believe, they can't answer. They give either no answer or their answer is so stupid. They're embarrassed. Most times they say nothing because they're too embarrassed to say something. But if they do say something, it just embarrasses them. It's really funny. Anyways, any question? We have time, maybe one or two questions.
Al, I think that video was a great comfort, I believe. At least one that I saw him actually interview professors.
Yeah, they did some professors on this one.
Eventually, if they accept their rules by faith, then why can't you accept religion by faith?
Yeah. Yeah, it is. I mean, and it really, that's really what they accept. If you really can get them pinned down, they will actually admit that they do it by faith eventually because they know they have no mechanism to defend their view. Charlie. I think they want to be wise in the eyes of man. I think that ultimately what it comes down to, they want to be accepted by their peers. I mean, I don't know. I can't come up with other explanations. They believe that the world has proved this beyond. I mean, what does the world say? And this is a deliberate strategy to put your enemies at so they can't answer. What do they tell you about global warming? And they tell you the same thing about evolution. The science is settled. There is no discussion. There's no debate. Now, is that scientific? Isn't that the exact opposite of what they say they promote? Reasoning and thinking and scientific. I mean, science is all about I have to keep exploring to find new evidence and new truths. And yet, it's settled. There's no discussion about this anymore. Why? Because they don't have no science behind them to debate, so they have to settle the argument by not having an argument. And that's, I think, ultimately, the church falls into that. I can't explain why so many people believe in evolution. If they even think about, I mean, again, and I've said this multiple times, if you believe in evolution, like I used to when I was in my 20s, you've got to do what Hitler said. You've got to exterminate people who are unfit. You need to eliminate their genes from the gene pool. That's what evolution teaches. You better purify your gene pool or you're going into extinction. I mean, you take all the infirm and you kill them. That's what evolution, or you at least sterilize them so they can't have offspring. That's what evolution demands. How can you say, I mean, they often talk about how can your, I can't accept a God that does, you know, does this stuff. And yet they believe in a God who, many of them that go to these churches, who is using a process which demands that you kill off your infirm. I don't, that's a tough argument for me to accept, but I don't think they realize that. Carol. Yeah, repeat the lie long, often enough, and eventually it'll become truth. And that seems to be working pretty well. Again, and then you say there's science is settled. So. Right. 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 And I've always felt that the thing that the evolutionists are and the non-Christian world is most against is Noah's flood. Because Noah's flood proves that God will judge you someday. And the thing that they want to avoid at all costs is accountability to God. I think a lot of the argument is all about Noah's flood and eliminating Noah's flood as a sign, as a truth of the world. They can discount that, then they can discount the fact that God, they're accountable to God. Well, we're past the time, so hopefully you all enjoy your break. We'll get downstairs now, right? And have a little social hour.